Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're going to be talking about interesting products today, right, Peter?
We're doing oil, wine, and fruits. There's a California connection in most of them, although Matt Skinner, who's our guest in the second portion of the program, is actually Australian. He's talking wine, which is very much a California language. Our first guest was so fascinating, we had to put him up front. Greg Hinson, the founder and the runner of Olive Oil Company.
He's great.
He just has an absolutely fascinating story, so why don't we just let him talk to you?
Greg Hinson is the president and founder of Olive Oil, and it is such a wonderful product line. I don't know how to sum it all up. What would you say, Greg?
There's a lot of creativity, and it's just... I guess it's an irreverent approach to olive oil and vinegars.
And yes, the vinegars are a very big part of it, at least half of it, isn't it?
I would say so. You know, I started making citrus olive oil, and that was my first experiment and my first real passion and love, and partly that came out of learning how to make olive oil, but then this magical fruit in California called the Meyer lemon.
And so, oh, yes.
First time I came back from Italy knowing how to make olive oil, I rented a press, and nobody out here, or actually in this country, had actually thought of doing citrus and olives together. And I'd heard about it when I lived in Italy, that it was a way to clean the presses at the end of the harvest.
So you actually did press them together.
I actually pressed them together, and I started with organic Meyer lemons, and I just did little batch experiments, and we threw the Meyer lemons in with the olives, and we crushed them together, and it came out as this magical elixir, and I knew instantly that it was something really, really unique and special.
Now, are other people in the world actually doing that, or did you just sort of accidentally on purpose make it up?
They were doing it in Italy, I was told. I actually never witnessed it, as a way to clean the granite wheels at the end of the production process.
So they weren't doing it deliberately.
They weren't doing it deliberately, and in fact, they considered that an adulterated product, and they gave it away or threw it away. And usually, it was left for the mill workers to take home, but it was never sanctified as an olive oil, and in fact, it was really frowned upon.
Well, we got some wonderful infused olive oils from Principessa in Molise.
That's who I was trying to think of.
The practically unknown province that lies between Puglia and Abruzzo.
Yeah, I think she's one of the few Italians that actually stuck her neck out and made it into a product.
I knew there was somebody who tasted it. It's a great product, too.
Now, whether she's making it the same way you are, that's a different... I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't know either. What I did was decide to just actually crush the entire citrus with the olive, and it was just kind of this magical way of getting the rind oil, the essential oils, out of the citrus to press with the olives.
And right.
But you have to do that organically, because that's where most of the pesticide stuff resides, in the rind, huh?
Exactly. You know, back when I started this in 1995, I was pretty adamant about making that a centerpiece of what we did on the quality front. And back then, there weren't that many organic citrus growers, and I met this man named Rich Johansson, and he was one of the few pioneers that had all organic Meyer lemons, and he was starting all organic blood oranges. And you're right, there, you know, what was in the marketplace then, supposedly the citrus was sprayed 30 to 45 times before it reached the consumer.
Every time I think of putting all those years, I sprinkled lemon zest on everything.
Well, hopefully you watched it really well.
Now, Greg, you've had something of a fascinating life's journey already, though. So before you planted olive trees, you were up to a few other things as well.
I was a small-town banker in Oklahoma, and what I found out from that experience was that I really didn't enjoy banking, but what I loved was the marketing of reforestation projects. So I found myself spending little time inside the bank, but doing a lot of tree planting on the outside. So I had a passion for planting trees. Then I ended up in California, met my wife in Los Angeles, and we took off for Italy when our first daughter was born, and had some great friends there. And suddenly I ended up in Florence And this family was trading these little jars of olive oil amongst themselves, and it was something I'd never seen before. I mean, I'd never tasted anything like this before. I really didn't even know about olive oil. I came from a butter background, so everything was butter or Wesson oil. And so here was this magical elixir everybody coveted and were trading around. And I learned a lot about olive oil from these families, and they had 3, 4, or 5 different types of olive oils, and, one was for pasta, one was for salads, and one was this style, one was peppery, one was butter, floury, and so that was kind of the awakening, and then came back from Italy, ended up in a botanical garden in Mexico, got back into my passion for trees, but when I was working with a lot of botanists, I heard about these kind of wildcats in California that were flying in rootstock out of Italy and planting Tuscan tree varieties, and at the end the experiment was whether you could reproduce a Tuscan style olive oil in California. So was it the land, or was it the trees, or was it the process? So that was very exciting, and I came back and kind of joined in on some of those experiments, and we got to go for a tour of all the olive presses in the south of France, and I came back and I had the bug, and I had to produce olive oil, so I rented a press and threw in the Meyer lemons, and took my first batch of olive oil to a chef in San Francisco.
Who was it?
It was Reed Heron and his executive chef, Scott Warner, at a restaurant called Rose Pistola.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And that was a real pioneering North Beach restaurant at the time, and they were
Is it gone? I guess it is, huh?
Yeah, it's still there. And,
oh, it's still there. Good, okay.
It's still there. Scott's no longer there. He's up in Napa now, but they were doing Ligurian-style cooking, so it fit perfectly with my Meyer lemon olive oil.
Oh, wow.
Scott tasted it, and he just said, bring me everything you made. So that was exciting. And
now, Greg, did you actually you have your own trees as well?
I have my own trees, but what I've done is I contract with families I've known for 14 years, 15 years, and so I work with specific orchards, and they actually manage the orchards, but then I buy their crop. So it's kind of a sharecropping arrangement, and where they, they still manage the property, but they produce all the olives for me.
I said we missed out a little step in your fascinating history, personal history, is you also attended art school. And the reason that I mentioned this is because when we were talking before, I said the packaging is so glorious on your olive oils and vinegars, and you said, thank you, that's mine.
Oh, that's true. I did leave that piece out. When I fled Oklahoma, I enrolled into the San Francisco Art Institute and got a master's degree in photography and the humanities. And one of my other passions in banking was design, and specifically typography and photography. So I was around all this food. I tried to figure out how can I make all this, tie together, my love for packaging and design and art and food, and it just seemed like the Bay Area was just ripe for that. Everybody had a real aesthetic sense for visual packaging, art, and an art appreciation. And it just kind of made sense, the beauty of food and the abundance of the bounty out here. So
now you're still based on Tuscan tree varieties, Greg?
I actually am only based on Spanish tree varieties.
Oh, okay.
Largest olive producer, olive oil producer in the world, Spain.
Exactly. And, I was lucky when I came into this process, there was this beautiful history ahead of me, which were the Spanish missions, and they had planted a lot of Spanish varietals.
Yeah, and then they were left.
Oh, okay. So you actually, did you use some of the old trees, or did you bring
the
new ones?
Yes, I did, and that was the beauty. They were basically abandoned, and so we kind of went back in and reshaped a lot of the orchards. And
That we interviewed Fran Gage, Fran.
Right. You probably know Fran Gage, right? She wrote a book.
I know of her. I actually went back last night and listened to your interview of her, so I'm dying to meet her. The newer ones. I'm kind of the old timer out here, but
She said that about the Spanish, I had planted all these, and then they just let them go. They had no interest in them whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because those trees were planted for table olives, but they make the most beautiful late season olives for what I'm trying to do. I was looking for an olive that was a very late ripening olive, because what I have to do is coordinate the ripening of the citrus to meet up with the ripening of the olives.
Oh, yeah, you would, wouldn't you?
So the mission olives are perfect for what I was looking for, and the taste profile was perfect because they're very buttery, they're very floral, And the marriage between that and the citrus is like the perfect combination. Whereas a Tuscan olive might be a little bit too peppery, a little bit too bitter for what I'm trying to do.
Now, you've got another side of the business altogether as well, called fine wine vinegars. And how did that one come about?
Well, it's funny. You know, after a couple of years of making olive oil, a lot of the chefs would say,
"What about
do you guys make vinegars?" I'm like, "No, we don't, but give me a few minutes." So I had a friend that was in the wine business, and I started talking to them, and I just said, "Wow, Zinfandel at that time was becoming this really big, you know, Americana, you know, quintessential wine, and there was a lot of Zinfandel buzz going on in California." So I just says, "Why don't we try doing a single varietal vinegar? There's not very many good ones on the market out here."
And there's Round Pond. I know that one.
Round Pond, I was actually ahead of those guys, but yeah, my friends that were doing it were up at Hans Fodden Winery, and but there was a lot of Zinfandel producers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I took this Zinfandel to New York, and we won a gold medal for it. And
at
the time, in 1997, there weren't any varietal vinegars on the market.
Oh, no, you were really early.
So that came out, and then the New York Times picked us up, and Florence Fabricant gave us her blessing. And, you know, if I backtrack a year before that, when we made the Meyer Lemon Olive Oil, we took it to New York and we won Product of the Year. And so that really opened a lot of doors for us as far as acceptance. But it was still a struggle. I mean, it was still, nobody really at that time knew that California made olive oil. And then the other piece of the puzzle was that nobody really knew what to do with the citrus olive oil. So there was a lot of consumer education about how to make it just a simple condiment or a finishing oil, if you will, that you just add to, you know, foods right before you serve them.
Now, one of the first, artisanal olive oils in California that we saw is it McAvoy, the McAvoy Ranch?
Yeah, Nan was one of the three Musketeer pioneers, I would say. She was one of the early ones to plant the Tuscan varietals, and that's actually where I used to crush my oil. She has this beautiful, beautiful stone press that, you know, I love, and she makes a gorgeous oil in West Marin, and we actually just moved from Marin to Petaluma. We're trying to get closer to the grapes, I guess.
Yeah, who do we know in Petaluma, Rabbit?
It's just beautiful up here.
We get Petaluma mixed up with the fact that Brian Crozo, who's a great Australian winemaker, called his wines Petaluma because he used to live there when he was at UC Davis.
Oh, that's right, too.
Oh, that's funny.
That's neat.
Yeah, I don't really know why he did that. Petaluma is not really a particularly attractive place, curiously enough.
Well, on the east side of Petaluma, it's gorgeous. It's rolling hills, and it rolls into Sonoma. So.
Right, but the town itself is, no, we drove through it, and it didn't look all that romantic. It didn't look as romantic as Napa and St. Helena and Yountville.
Well, you'd be surprised. What they've done is gone back into the downtown area, and they're kind of fixing up the old warehouse industrial area right now. So there's a big resurgence, and one of the big footprints that they got was Cowgirl Creamery, which are this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Lovely.
They've moved downtown, and so they brought a lot of good energy, and there's some new activity. I don't know the last time you were there, but
we're leaving Monday to...
We're actually going to be in Napa and Sonoma for 5 days starting
Monday.
Yeah, well, it's definitely hard to compete with Napa and Sonoma. They're pretty, you know, picture postcard, and they've got a lot of history, so I'll give you that one.
So anyway, back to your wine vinegars, then. You did the Zinfandel one, but now you've got couple of handfuls.
I mean, these. Let me just read you some of these. I have to admit, I have not tasted these, but I certainly hope I'll have a chance to. We have cassis, champagne, sherry, pinot noir. Here's one called California balsamic, white balsamic. Which, by the way, I don't believe there is a white balsamic. I'm, you know, from an Italian background.
Okay.
California port balsamic, pomegranate. That ought to be fabulous. Cuvée, Cabernet, Zinfandel, Porto, and then you have citrus, champagne, vinegar, and ginger rice. That's unusual. One of rice vinegar.
Yeah,
I mean, you
don't
think of that with California, do you?
Oh, I do, because everything is so Pacific Rim oriented here.
But I mean, making it. And then, I never think of California making ginger rice vinegar, but
we actually
yuzu has to be fabulous. Yuzu.
It's great.
Yeah, and then yuzu is
where do you get the yuzu?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get your yuzu?
You know what? It's a very, very difficult crop to grow here, and it's just starting. Originally, I tagged along with Wolfgang Puck, and we're having to actually import the skins. We bring in the frozen skins from Japan.
Well, that's how the restaurateurs do that to chefs.
Exactly. Right. Now I've got some friends that are actually growing yuzu. There's just a tiny crop.
In California.
Wow. So it's a very finicky plant. It only grows at a certain elevation, and it's very cold sensitive. As you know, it's usually only grown just for the rind. There's really very little juice on the inside. So it's an expensive crop and a specialty crop that luckily is a giant crop in Japan, and they revere it, and they use it in a lot of festivals. So
I wrote a headline for a sushi restaurant review I did called Yuzu Something to Me. I'm sorry. I mean, this is uncalled for, but I just think that was funny.
Yeah, the playwright suit from the yuzu producers of Japan will be arriving shortly. Now you've publicized that even more. So okay, Mr. Gregg. So what's next? I mean, what you can't be standing still. I can't believe
what would actually
be going on.
We're up for a word right now for our balsamics. That's funny you mentioned that the white balsamic, and I guess that is controversial. Three people work here are Sicilian.
Well, that's my background, yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we have a thing in California called Prop 65, and it's a thing about lead content in food products. And it's a big thing that came out of a water management decree a couple of years ago. And what they're finding out is all the supermarkets, especially stores like Whole Foods, Andronico's, higher-end specialty stores have to put this warning label about balsamics that are imported that don't meet this threshold of lead content.
They don't?
Or rather, they're above lead content.
They're too high.
Now, why? Is it because how they're aged?
Well, they're trying, you know, nobody knows, and this has been in the courts for years and years, but kind of the general idea is that it's either it's a combination of the ground is polluted or it's the old irrigation pipes. Nobody can really trace where the exact.
You mean like in Modena and places like that?
Yeah, so, you know, people are pretty, it's a pretty big forefront issue out here, and it's spreading, you know, along the West Coast. And there's signage in stores, and if you don't meet this threshold, you actually have to label it on your product that your product contains lead. So we got really freaked out, and we just said, you know, let's control this. Let's just control the ingredients. So we started making our own balsamics 5 years ago in Sonoma, and we just wanted to know where the ingredients were coming from. We wanted to control the process. And our product is coming in 70% under the threshold. So we're happy with that, and we're actually up for an award in New York this summer.
Linda, are you a finalist, Sophie finalist?
We are. We're a finalist, and it's actually for our balsamic trio. It's our white balsamic, our port balsamic, and our what we just call our California aged balsamic.
I was just about to start in on that because I do an overview of the Fancy Food Show every year for for the Tribune, and so I start in early. So I got totally overwhelmed. This has grown so huge since I started doing this.
We've won 14 times, and
that's where I first saw your product.
Probably. Last year we were up for our cassis vinegar, which is pretty spectacular. It's a champagne based, and then we seep it with black currants. And the funny thing that's happening with that vinegar right now is it's being featured in a lot of bars to go into a martini. Instead of like a classic Cure Royale, bartenders are kind of avoiding the sweet side and wanting to go more on the kind of the sour side. So that's kind of a funny use. But chefs love the cassis vinegar because it's just beautiful when you're pan-searing duck or wild rice.
Well, I'm going to try that one too.
Yeah.
How about giving us because you have an informative website. How about giving it to our listeners?
Our website is www.oliveoil.com. It's the two O's together in the front, which kind of looks good. And if you go there, there's all kinds of sections where you can see how we actually produce the oils, and you can see an array of our products, and there's a lot of recipes and serving suggestions. And probably the thing that I love most about our products are the simplicity, and we're constantly doing demonstrations where we tell people that think of it as a finishing oil right before you serve. Even if you bring home a deli chicken, just drizzle some of the lime olive oil over it, and it just enhances it and creates, you know, this excitement.
And do you and buy vegetables. It on the website, or do you go to Whole Foods?
I'm sorry?
Do you sell from the website, or do you have to go to
Whole
Foods?
We do sell from our website, and we actually thought about you guys. If you put in a discount code, and we can actually give your readership a discount if they go there and just type in, if you give me a code, we can program it, and then people can get 20% off of our website.
Now that's good. We'll put an update on that. Did you know
how
to do that?
And the other thing is, you know, nationally we're available at Whole Foods on the East Coast, where places like Fresh Market and Earth Fair.
Now, I have a question. Even with my 10% discount, did you say 10%?
20%.
20%. If I bought each one of these olive oils and vinegars, what would I be spending?
Well, the oils, that's interesting. You know, the oils probably retail out here on the West Coast for around $16 a piece, which sounds very expensive, but the thing is, if you just need a little bit to add flavor, and that's how chefs use them. They, you know, you don't really cook with them. We don't tell people to do that. Just think of it as a finishing oil. Right before you serve a platter of steamed asparagus, just drizzle a little bit of Meyer lemon on top. Bottle will last quite a while that way.
Well, you have 10 of those oils, and then how many? 16?
16 vinegars. And, you know, that's funny that we talked about white balsamic, because that's probably the one that the chefs are ordering the most right now. And it's interesting because kind of our approach to the white balsamic is a lot of European white balsamics basically take a regular balsamic and then strip out the color.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to start from the bottom and build in the flavor. So we started with the champagne base, and then we used Malvasia grapes, and we wanted to add kind of that dessert wine flavor.
Well, you're wonderful. Greg, I mean, you're a superman and a super renaissance man, and your products are gorgeous looking, and they sound absolutely fabulous, and what we've tasted has been delicious, very strong in flavor. I mean, like, pure and high on flavor, if that makes any sense.
It does, and I think it's that pure process, and unlike an infusion, I think it's when we crush the actual citrus with the olives, there's this natural bonding, and that's what chefs are attracted to, is that purity and the intensity of the flavor.
Well, good luck on the Sophie thing, and we're going to see you. Will you be there at the Fancy Food Show?
I'll be there. Please come by.
I'll come by. Yeah.
Thank you.
We absolutely will, and we hope you're right.
And give us the information about the coupon thing.
And we hope that you'll continue to have a wonderful life adventure, and I'm sure you will.
I will. Thank you very much. I love food, and I love the creative process, so it's perfect for both of those things.
Great. Now, so we'll have to do a follow-up because you didn't tell us what you're up to next.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Greg.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Don't you just want to talk to this nice young man forever and ever and ever?
I said I'd like to just go there and hang out with him all the time.
So he's so much to say. Yeah, so we'll have him back on the program for sure, but for now, it's time to take a
break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Email us, please, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, or tweet me, OTM Dish, or check me out on Facebook, Ann Haig.
She's everywhere.
I'm absolutely everywhere.
And then Peter gets to,
is on Plaxo.
Peter gets to do the dumb old blog at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Right. But I knew there was another one.
Keep those emails and Twitters coming in, because guess what Miss Ann got for Mother's Day? For Mother's Day, Miss Ann got a crackberry, so she now needs something to use it for. You'll have an exciting new way of...
Now, first, I have to get it away from my husband, who has it hooked onto his belt.
The only reason that I have it is because I'm trying to figure out how to
Anyhow,
use it.
Anyhow, our next guest is just...
Oh, who can
really,
we're going to talk about the next guest.
We're
going to bullshit about crackberries forever.
No, Matt Skinner turned out to be a wonderful person to talk to. We had so much to say before and after, even on the air. I guess we just have a lot in common. He's from originally from Australia.
And he may not know everything about wine, but he sure knows a lot more about it than you and I do. And
he's fun.
Matt Skinner is a young Australian, at least he looks a whole lot younger than I do, on the cover of his book, which is called Heard It Through the Grapevine.
You should know to enjoy wine.
Yeah, Matt promises this is the only book you'll need for a beginner's appreciation of wine, nothing if not a bold man. Matt, welcome to On the Menu Radio.
Thank you, guys. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I like this other thing on the cover. It says, I have learned more about wine from Matt than anyone else, and that's from Jamie Oliver, the Naked Chef.
It was a lovely endorsement.
We must let Anne tell her Jamie story while we have the chance.
No, we won't.
No,
do
we're
that.
Not going to do the Jamie story.
No.
Okay. I'll do the Jamie story because she sent Jamie a tweet because his picture's on her homepage and he got a reply. She got a reply back in a matter of minutes.
Yeah.
So busy man though he is, he's still following what's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
And you have an affiliation with him. Perhaps you can tell us about that first.
I met Jamie in sort of 2001 early 2000, I think it was, and we met in Melbourne and he was out, I think, doing some book publicity, and he was talking about the concept of doing something with young people and a training facility that sort of doubled as a working restaurant, and that grew into the concept of 15. So I moved from Australia to help Jamie set 15 up in 2002, and I looked after all of the wine side of operations for 15, and then as we grew the 15 group, and we've now got restaurants in Amsterdam, in Melbourne, we've got two in the UK, and we're looking at opening another branch of 15 in South Africa next year. So that's my involvement with 15, but also with Jamie, I work on the wine operations of his other projects too.
Right, now you're originally Australian, from Melbourne, I think?
Yep, that's right, from down south.
But then you spent several years in London just recently.
Yeah, I'm. As I said, I moved in 2002, and I stayed there until about just over a year ago now. So I was there for sort of just over 6 years, and it was a fantastic experience. Like to be able to travel and get to see not only the UK, but also to get France, Italy, Germany, Spain, and for me as a wine lover and a food lover as well, it was brilliant and certainly fantastic for my education.
Now, what gave you the idea to do this book? I mean, there are lots and lots of books that would pretend they do the same thing as you just did. So what made you think that you had something special to contribute, Matt?
I've worked in wine now full-time for 15 years, and I started in wine as an 18-year-old, and I found it incredibly intimidating and a little bit confusing, like most people, and I wasn't quite sure where to begin, and I had to really take myself outside my comfort zone. That was the first thing I needed. I had to realize to take myself outside my comfort zone and ask all those questions that I'd always been too afraid to ask, and to just kind of to taste and to experience the world of wine. And I realized as I got into it that it wasn't as highbrow as I thought it might be. It didn't quite have the scary connotations that I thought it might have. It's language, it has its stereotype. But I remember doing a wine course sort of pretty soon after I'd started in wine, an introductory course, and I just remember being blown away by the fact that wine was this incredible collision between science, history, geography, and Mother Nature, that really fascinated me, and that was, I think, the point where, for me, wine became more than just liquid inside a bottle or inside a glass.
That's a lovely description and a great starting point for us. Now, the clever thing about this book is it starts out saying, okay, so where are you going to shop for wine? How are you going to get some in the first place? tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I laid it out I wanted to lay it out in a very logical kind of way. So how you buy it, so that's obviously the starting point. And I think in the 15 years that I've been in wine, the options for buying wine have increased and changed dramatically. The landscape with the internet now has meant that there's sort of virtual shop fronts opposed to sort of, you know, high street stores. And then on the high street, you have everything from supermarkets, you know, through to independent wine merchants and specialist fine wine merchants. And so really the range of options is huge. And what I try and cover in the book is, I don't try and recommend that people do go to one or the other, but I try to give them the pros and cons of each. In a supermarket, for example, you might get a fantastic range of wines that are very affordable because they benefit from great buying power, but you probably don't have somebody standing in the aisle to give you advice.
You seem
a little bit of homework.
Yeah, and you don't know how it's been stored either.
Yeah, you seem to
That's
like
exactly right.
You seem to like the independent wine merchant probably the best.
Well, I've been one before, so I kind of know what it's like. And what I try to say to people is that you might pay a little bit more, but the range will change. You'll find that because you're not a multiple, what you normally find is that these guys can afford to buy a couple of cases here, a case there, of sort of special boutique things that you wouldn't find on the supermarket shelves. And the chances are that the person that's standing behind the counter is more often not the person that owns the store or has a share in the store. So you can benefit from their knowledge, their passion, their enthusiasm, and that becomes pretty infectious. So it is a great way to buy.
Now, then you go on and talk about some useful things like the sizes of bottles and why cork or why not cork.
What does he come down
What makes a good year? Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, how do you come down on the screw cap issue?
I'm a fan of screw caps. That being said, I don't think that the industry's given up looking for the kind of perfect alternative. We have screw caps because it's estimated that somewhere between 5% and 7% of everything bottled under a conventional cork ends up being tainted by a bacteria known as TCA or trichloroethanol.
Yeah.
And that can be really obvious, where we can all smell it and it smells like wet cardboard, or it can be in really low doses where even I struggle to pick it up, and I taste wine for a living, and it's those bottles that people order in restaurants, and they drink the wine, they don't realise it's corked, and they think, well, I don't particularly like that wine, I'll never order that again.
Right.
And that's every winemaker's worst nightmare, so that's why we have screw caps. So, you know, I think they're the best solution we've got at the moment to a problem that costs the industry an enormous amount of money every year.
Now, then you go on next to figuring out how to select a wine that you'll love, and then how to serve that to your friends, and how to go about tasting wine. So that's a sensible sort of chapter. And
yep.
are you sort of telling the story of your life as you became a more sophisticated wine drinker?
Yeah, I think I am. I think there's sort of a lot of my experience in the, you know, personal experience in the book, and I sort of, you know, things that I've encountered along the way that have helped me. And, you know, sort of say at the start, it's the little pearls of wisdom and the bits of good advice and the tips that I picked up throughout the course of my career. But yeah, little things can make all the difference to your drinking experience, like having the right glasses, like having a decanter, you know. And for 5 years that I've been traveling and sort of doing tastings in different parts of the world, you tend to find that a lot of the questions are the same about wine and people's worries and the things that intrigue them. And I always ask them, you know, to put their hands up if they've got a decanter. And inevitably three or four hands in a room of 50 or 60 people go up. And, you know, I try and decant pretty much everything, all my reds and most of my full-bodied whites as well.
Have you run into this Venturi, which is what we've been using lately?
Venturi?
It's a fabulous gadget. I mean, you just got to get two, one for white and one for red. We just got the one for white. Essentially, it's a you pour your wine through this device, and it aerates it, so it puts huge bubbles, almost like frog spawn, on top of the wine, but it really opens it up very, very quickly.
He's not going to put some kind of a term on me, that frog spawn.
Well, I mean, bubbles on a surface, why not?
Yeah, well, it sounds like it does, you know, a much quicker job, and it sounds like a great idea. But I always liken the process of decanting, you know, to being a little bit like us, when we go on a long-haul flight somewhere, the first thing you want to do when you get off is have a bit of a stretch, probably have a shower, freshen up a little bit. Yeah. And the same thing with wine. Wine's a living, breathing thing, and it's trapped inside this environment, being a glass bottle. And the first thing you should do is give it a chance to have a bit of a breathe and open up and to show its best.
No, you're absolutely right. So, listeners, if that's a fascinating piece of advice. I mean, if you don't have a decanter, what we're saying is, if you don't have a decanter, then you really don't have one of the primary tools required in order to be able to appreciate wine the way that the winemaker expected it would be drunk.
Exactly, but it doesn't have to be an expensive decanter either. It can be, it just needs to be a vessel where you can transfer the liquid from a bottle into something larger with a wide surface area. So a jug, if you can't afford a decanter, a jug is fine, so long as it's, you know, glass tends to be best, and so long as it has a wide surface area. And then you can either transfer it back to the bottle again, or you can pour it into a glass and continue the aeration process.
Now, next up in the book is pairing food and wine, figuring out what wine goes with what, and a few other things that are helpful to people consuming. Do you have any rules of thumb? I mean, the standard rules of thumb, like white wine with white meat and red wine with red meat, seem to be breaking down just a little bit.
They do. I fall somewhere into the middle. I'm not a hardcore traditionalist, and at the same time, you know, there's a lot of incredible stuff going on in places like Spain at the moment, where sommeliers are really pushing the boundaries of sort of conventional food and wine matching, and some of them work and some of them don't, but, you know, it's amazing just seeing kind of some of the interesting matches that they're doing. I think I'll probably fall somewhere in the middle. I like being surprised by the new school, but at the same time I sort of understand why some of those rules were set in the past, but I am a big believer that, you know, well-chosen wine can make average food taste better and vice versa. So I just try and give people a starting point by thinking about the weight of their food and the weight of their wine, and trying to get those two things as evenly matched up as possible at the beginning, and then to look for sort of flavour hooks between the wine and the food, and to think about texture as well, because obviously, no, wine is, for me, is as much about texture as it is about aroma and flavour. And
Matt, you're brilliant. Do you know that? You're amazing.
This is a lovely book. This is a lovely book
to
read. I'm on this particular page called How to Match Food and Wine, and Matt writes, like Lennon and McCartney, some things were just meant to be. but then the good advice is drink good champagne with fish and chips.
I agree.
Yeah, and do it on the beach.
For sure, because, you know, I think a lot of people's fondest memories of wine aren't just about the wine that they were drinking. They're about the place they were, who they were with, and what they were eating, and you know, that's certainly the case for me, and, you know, some of my happiest memories are kind of having, you know, very inexpensive meals with great bottles, and sometimes inexpensive bottles, but with the people that I love, and I think that's just meant to be an illustration of that. Fish and chips on the beach, nice sunset, some good company, and some good champagne. That's what could be better.
To make sure that you understand the extent to which Matt covers everything, I just turned over to a page called The Opened Bottle. Now, I will preface this by saying that
we're not experienced.
We have opened bottles sometimes. We did get a recorking device, actually pumped air back into champagne bottles. Because everyone needs to know what to do with their half-empty bottles of sparkling wine.
That's right.
I must confess that is a problem that the Hague household has never faced, and I'll bet the Skinner one's probably a little bit like that too.
Yeah, there aren't too many half-finished bottles of wine in our place.
but you have them, and you recommend what to do with them, and then you've got recommendations about how wines change over time.
Yep.
I want to cover just one thing with you before we conclude, because I'm not sure whether I believe this or not, and you're an expert, so we'll try you on this. Various times people have told me that after about 3 years, I'm talking mostly red wines here, after about 3 years in the bottle, wine goes kind of funny, and it can be funky for the next 4 or 5 years. So the smart thing to do with a red wine is to drink it young, if it's suitable to drink young, or to keep it until it's got some age on and avoid that funk period. Now, is what I'm saying, does that meet your opinion as well?
Well, every variety is different, and every variety sort of has a different journey. And what I would say is varieties like Riesling, for example, is well known for looking fantastic as soon as it's bottled and sort of for the first sort of 3 to 5 months after it's bottled. And then it goes into what we call a dumb phase, where it really drops, the aromas kind of drop out and they sort of, it almost becomes slightly muted and a little bit more one-dimensional, and it closes down and you have to wait some time for that to sort of come back up again and before it really sort of shows. And that can be, you know, kind of a 6 to 12 month period. The other thing I'd say is that Pinot Noir, for example, is a very delicate grape variety, and it really relies on its aromatics and its texture, and it can be knocked around a lot during travel. And often you'll find that people who import Burgundy from different parts of the world, great merchants, will actually leave the wine at the point of it's received and let it just sit and settle for a matter of weeks or in some cases months, just so that it has a chance to kind of recover. And so, yeah, different varieties, particularly the lighter, delicate varieties, they're the ones that are probably most susceptible to what you're talking about. But sort of more robust varieties, I guess, like Cabernet or Shiraz or Zinfandel, Chardonnay, those kind of things, tend to be able to kind of cope a little bit better.
Oh, so, okay, so this generic sort of dumb period that lasts several years is maybe a figment of somebody's imagination, you think?
It sounds a little bit like a generalisation, because I find it difficult to think about all wine as being the same and all grapes as being the same. They all, sure, you know, they're a little bit like us, and, you know, we all have different mannerisms, and grapes are the same.
Now, before you sign off, give us a couple of your absolute favourite wines. First of all, a white and then a red. Out of all the wines you've drunk, which must have been quite a lot, there's got to be one that stands out.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of Burgundy in France, and probably white Burgundy. You know, someone asked me about my desert island dish the other day, and or my desert island meal, and I think there's a producer called Cruche Jury from Meursault in France, so a fantastic Chardonnay producer, and his wines I'd happily walk over hot coals to get.
Okay, so that's a Meursault, a white Burgundy.
From a producer called Cruche Jury, yeah, he's fantastic.
We just interviewed the winner of the Best Sommelier in America, and who's at Le Bernardin, and his favorite to die for was white Burgundy as well.
I
love it. I mean, there's producers like, you know, Ramonet, Domaine Laflave, some great names, and but Cruche Jury would be my absolute favorite.
Yeah, Peter's going to correct me.
No, I'm going to contradict Dan, because I remember better. He said it was a 1976 Riesling from the Moselle region, and he knew the producer's name. He said, I had one once and it was wonderful. And I said, well, what are you going to do now? He said, well, I do have one at home.
Oh, what a lucky man.
Said that they love white Burgundy, then.
He said he liked Burgundies generally, but this was his particular... No, he liked both, I think. Uh-huh. Now, what about a red? Are you staying in Burgundy or are you going somewhere else?
I don't have my favourite white in my cellar at the moment, but I have my favourite red. And it was a bottle of Sassicaia from Italy from a producer called Snuda San Guido. Sassicaia is the name of the wine. 85 was the vintage, and it was one of their all-time classics. And I managed to buy a couple of bottles when I was living in the UK. And so I still have one tucked away in the cellar, and I'm not sure when I'll open that.
You'll invite us over, and we'll drink it.
Next time you're in town.
Well, we have an old friend here in Pittsburgh called Jim Israel, who would absolutely adore Sassicaia as well.
Yeah.
I think Anne's favorite of all time was a 1990 Penfold Grange.
Well, funnily enough, I got to taste that wine the other day, Anne. I went to a museum tasting in the Barossa Valley in South Australia, and they put on some fantastic old wines, including a vintage port from 1908, which was just phenomenal, and it sort of looked sort of like a sort of very dried out version of Pedro Jimenez from the south of Spain. But we got to see 90 Grange, which I think was Wine Spectator's Wine of the Year.
It was the wine that singularly put Australian wines on the map.
Absolutely, I'm happy to report that it looks fantastic at kind of 19 years of age, and it looks sensational.
Well, we drank it last year at the restaurant at the Penfolds Estate in Adelaide. So we had a personal experience, and it certainly was fantastic.
Now, Matt, I just want to add that anybody who wants this book, it's on our website, And as we haven't mentioned, it's so nicely produced graphically and otherwise it's colorful, it's accessible, and just loaded with information. I think that everybody should try this who wants to start in on the wine trail. And I think that, do you have also a website you'd like to give out?
Yeah, I have mattskinner.net, and people can sort of find me that way. And obviously the book, there's a link through to the book on amazon.com from
right.
that point. So, yeah.
Great. Well, have a wonderful journey. Or you're off to San Francisco and then I guess heading back home down under. So we hope that your journey is smooth and you have wonderful food and wine wherever you go. And thank you so much for contributing this book to the cosmos. We're all very grateful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Congratulations on a really excellent book.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be on the program, so thank you for having me.
Yeah, and maybe we'll visit you next year.
Look forward to it.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
All the best.
Bye-bye. And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and heading along into another very, very delicious product, La Vigne.
And another part of the bountiful state of California.
Oh, yeah.
And this case, Southern California, almost down as far as San Diego, where there's an old industry growing avocados and a new industry growing exotic kinds of fruit. And
like
we caught up with someone who's right in the middle of doing that and making wonderful products out of it.
Isn't it funny what you find out when you're sitting next to interesting people at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival?
Yeah,
that's why we met our.
That was serendipitous.
That's why we met our upcoming guest, who's talking
Helene
to us right
Beck.
Now, Helene Beck. And Anne, why don't you go ahead and introduce Helene?
Yeah, Helene is her company is. She's going to have to explain this all to you, but it's La Vigne Fruits. And it's La Vigne Organics, I think, to be more specific, Helene, isn't it?
That's so.
And give us just some idea. I want to start out by saying the products are absolutely scrumptious, but let's go from there. Explain what the company is.
Well, the company is a condiment company resourcing kumquats and persimmons, blood oranges, Meyer lemons. These are all organic and biodynamically certified organic as well. So the company is based on promoting the uses of persimmons and kumquats in jar form so that you or I, in a moment's notice, want to upgrade your fish, your shrimp, your chicken, your pork, whatever it is you have. And these sauces are just a nice complement.
Or you can do what we do is we eat them out of the jar with a spoon. They're that good.
Now the little piece of heaven where you grow all this produce is well. I mean, we know, but tell our listeners where it is.
Well, we're located in Fallbrook, California, which is part of San Diego County. It's just in back of Camp Pendleton. It was known as an avocado world once upon a time, but since then things have changed, as most things do, and we are here as a more citrusy-oriented. We didn't stick with avocados because we had bought into a declining avocado orchard. And instead of babying the trees, we decided we'd start fresh.
Uh-huh. Now, there are people who are growing nuts and various different kinds in your region as well, right?
Yes, they grow macadamia nuts.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think they grow I think they grow pistachios, too.
Yes, they do.
Uh-huh. And we have talked to people who produce avocado oil-based products. I think they're called Pacific Grove or something like that. So there's still some avocado work going on. But it's a really God-given, God-heaven-blessed, wonderful, dry, warm climate with just enough rain in the wintertime just to keep it all going. I think I'm right there.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And in our case, because we grow blood oranges, they need a very cold winter and a hot, dry summer.
Do they?
That turns the color and the sweetness and the citrus.
Oh, I love blood oranges. I mean, I think anything with blood oranges is fabulous.
Tell us, how old is your company?
Oh, it's about 12 years old.
Okay. And how many products do you have?
Well, I think we're up to about 11 or 12.
Right. And I can just run through some of these. It says specializing in less mainstream fruits such as persimmons and kumquats, which is with a K. I'm looking at it now and I can't imagine I put a C there. Sauces, kumquat ginger syrup, conserves, dried fruits and leathers, purees, blood orange juice, Moroccan preserved lemons, and fresh produce. And it's all organic, listeners. And not only is it organic, it's certified as biodynamic. How about telling our listeners what that's about, Helene?
Well, biodynamic farming is something that relies on the total inputs of what you have on your own property. And because the plant life is so intimately bound up with the soil, biodynamics helps to grow stronger vegetables or fruits because the soil is enriched. It's enriched with humus, which is full of microorganisms.
But it's enriched in a natural way, rather than
rather than
putting chemical fertilizers all over it.
Exactly. We have to depend on our own resources. We recycle everything that we don't use gets recycled onto our own compost piles or into our own humus.
It's like a whole system. The founder's name is
Rudolf Steiner.
Yes, and I think if you read his works, you might find him a little quirky, to put it mildly. But at the same time, everybody I talk to who does this system says the product's better.
Yeah,
wines is the same thing.
Yeah, it just works. We just talked to somebody from the Collin Wine Estate, one of Western Australia's largest wineries, and they credit biodynamic change to biodynamism, I suppose you might call it, for their vineyard as essentially saving it from a lingering death. So I don't know that anybody really knows scientifically why it works. They just know it does.
It has phases of the moon. It has all sorts of things involved with it, right, Helene?
Yes, that's true, too.
So if you're nuts about persimmons and you're nuts about kumquats or you are interested
or you're
interested in experimenting with a really remarkable set of new, slightly sour taste sensations, where would you be able to get this wonderful stuff?
See, I wouldn't call it sour at all. I'd call it it was very bright.
I think kumquats would certainly be in the bitter category. Don't you think?
Yes, and
but you put some in syrup.
Oh, well, I understand, but they start off with a different flavor profile than an orange.
And yes, they are wee little pieces of fruit. They are the size of a giant olive. They're ovate in shape. They have four little seeds in the center of each and every one of them. That's God's intention. And when you eat them, the sweetness is in the skin and the interior has the sour. And when you chew them together, you get this sweet sour, and some people just adore it.
I do too. I mean, I told you we have had a tree in our yard in Australia, and I couldn't get enough of them. I just love them.
Isn't that nice to hear?
Oh, yeah.
I think more people ought to experiment and try it, and they might find the same satisfaction.
Okay, so back to my question. How do people lay their hands on these products? That was really my question.
Oh, I'm sorry. The fruits can be fresh. They can be bought at Whole Foods or some of the local markets that are organically purposeful. You can get them on the East Coast. There's a distributor over there by the name of Angelos, and he would be the one that knows where all our fruit gets dispersed. We have a co-op in Minnesota. It's called People's Co-op, I've forgotten the actual title. It'll come to me in a minute. And there are various locations in San Francisco. It's distributed by Veritable Vegetable, and it goes into places like Berkeley Bowl or Sacramento Co-op. Down here in San Diego, we have Jimbo's, and we have some of Whole Foods. There's places in Texas. Because we sell to distributors, we don't know exactly which stores they get into, but if they choose, they can go to their produce buyer in any of their departments, you know, any one of the stores, and request Beck Grove, and they can get it that way.
Now, how about your website? What can they do anything through that?
Yes, I think we've made a provision that you can buy it. A lot of our fruit can be sold individually to people that are in the, you know, lie in areas that are hard to get to, and they can buy it through the computer, through the website,
which is,
and we ship out on Mondays.
And what is the website?
The website is Lavigne Fruits.
Lavigne
mm-hmm.
Fruits, plural.
.com.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just lovely stuff. I didn't.
Well, they go online, they will see, you know, and they can select what they might like and go to the store and point to what they might print out on their from their computer or their printer and ask for it.
Right.
Otherwise, now, going online is quite satisfactory, too.
Yeah. Why were you in Charleston? I'm trying to remember.
Why? Because I follow fruit. I follow food. I'm a foodie from way back. I've collected cookbooks from many, many years, and I've got quite a collection, and now it gets to the point people know about it, and they donate books to me, and I go through the books, and in fact, sometimes I get kind of confused. I won't repeat anything. I just keep moving on, forgetting where I found the one I really liked.
Uh-huh.
I think if I ever did a cookbook,
yeah, well, you should see our cookbooks. I mean, they're moving in and out of the house 150 at a time.
Yeah.
Because of the program, obviously. You were telling us about an ingenious recipe, a dessert, involving persimmons. Can you repeat that for our listeners?
Yes, this is a very handy, simple way to use your surplus or out-of-hand persimmons. If they get too ripe for you, there are one of two things that you can really do. You can freeze them and store them forever because they're second sweetest to a date. And you can then take them out of the freezer in this frozen state, cut them up in wedges, place them on a plate, pour rich cream on top of them, which will stick to it and adhere to it as though it was icing. And then you can crack nice, fresh black pepper across it and serve it with a ginger cookie. And it makes a marvelous dessert in the easiest, fastest way possible to your family and friends.
That's on my list because I don't bake. What's going on there? Well, Helene, it's really wonderful. Are you going to be at the Fancy Food Show?
I wasn't thinking about it.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say I'd see you there, but if not, I'm sure we'll run into each other at another food festival.
Oh, I hope so. If not, if you're out this way and you choose to come visit, we have a nice little cottage you can stay in, and most people enjoy just, you know, being in this environment, you know, where the trees or some part of the grove is in blossom or it's fruiting out, and it's kind of nice to see.
You sound like you have a wonderful life.
I truly enjoy it. I really do.
Well, Helene, thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Yeah. And I'm so glad that we've made it noticeable to the public that there are lots of things you can do with persimmons, either fresh or in jars.
Right. And don't forget our favorite kumquats.
Yes, as well as kumquats.
Okay, Helene. Till we meet again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's a wrap for another week of On the Menu Radio. We hope you enjoyed the program and you join us again same time, same place next week when I expect we'll have more excitement from California that you're sure to want to listen to.
Till then.
Bye-bye.